This is the second session. I'm David Hookema. The second session I'm leading on topics in nonviolence and pacifism. And this discussion, for the purposes of the tape, is devoted to Thomas Keneally's novel Schindler's List. I would like to give two different introductions to this book, and two sort of reasons why I think it's appropriate. The first has to do with teaching, not so much with what we're doing in the sessions that I'm leading here at Holden. The second with the connection between this and issues of pacifism and nonviolence. The first introduction is this. Like some others of you, I think, I regularly teach ethics. I don't know if any of the rest of you are primarily philosophers, but the philosophical teaching of ethics has traditionally been mainly devoted to teaching alternative theories of ethics, issues having to do with the meaning of ethical terms, whether there is a truth or falsity about ethical claims, alternative theories of ethics such as result-oriented theories, rule-oriented theories, character-oriented theories, and the like. And after teaching that a number of times, I began more and more to be convinced that there was an enormous lacuna in teaching ethics when we focused only on issues of principle, on, so to speak, abstracted moral choices. And so I started regularly, whenever I taught a course in ethics, assigning, in addition to some books on ethical theory, one or two or three novels or other books that describe moral choices in concrete situations. What I like the term that Clifford Geertz uses of anthropology, that they offered a kind of thick description of moral choices. Because it seemed to me that reading about people making choices in either actual situations or fictional situations gave students a sense of what real morality is about in a way that's much clearer than the kinds of examples that philosophers are fond of using. If you read philosophers on ethics, you may come to think that the moral life consists of hurtling down a tramway and deciding whether to continue on your present path and kill two people or go off onto a siding and kill 10. well, those are interesting abstract questions to ponder, and certainly a thoroughly worked out ethical theory needs to be able to face hypothetical questions of that kind. But it came to seem to me more and more that that's a kind of distortion of what ethics is if you don't look at it in real human situations. So I started using both novels and nonfiction accounts. I used a variety of them. One that I've used that in some ways covers some of the same ground as Keneally's Schindler's List is Philip Hallie's Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, which some of you may know. It's a very moving account of the ministry of André Trocmé, a reformed pastor in occupied France, who took on, and whose village really supported him in taking on the ministry of hiding Jews and partisans from the Nazis. It's a very vivid picture, though in a way it's the book itself is so heavily interpreted, it's so much a moral theory overlaid on certain events that it doesn't focus so much on the day-to-day events. I've used John Irving's Cider House Rules to focus on issues of abortion in a way that's much more real than most of the theoretical discussions. Marge Percy's Woman on the Edge of Time to focus on issues of sex roles. And I've used Schindler's List regularly to focus on issues of life, protection of life, and especially moral character. Because I think using this kind of, this is a kind of hybrid. It's a novelized nonfiction story. It's a piece of a narrative that tells a true story, but tells it in a novelist's way, and as Keneally says in the introduction, tells it in a way with the novelist's freedoms. He feels free to make up conversations, to embellish details, not pretending that he was an omniscient observer at all when it happened, but wanting to fill it in with something of the richness of a novelist's description. So that's introduction one. I think it's very useful in studying ethics to use books like this. Introduction two, to situate this in the context of issues of nonviolence and pacifism. The second question that every pacifist faces in every serious conversation with someone who is not persuaded by pacifism, after the question I mentioned yesterday, namely, what if someone is raping your grandmother, is the question, what would you have done in World War II? And both of them are perfectly fair questions. The question about World War II is, of course, based on that being probably the clearest example of any war in recent human history of a force that was simply unlimited in the depth to which it stooped for evil ends, One side seemingly knew no bounds, and the other side felt probably a stronger sense than in any recent war of a moral sanction, a moral imperative for its fight. What would you do if you were a pacifist in World War II? Well, part of the answer I said yesterday has to do with wanting to shift the question. What would you do if you were a pacifist in 1939 is a different question from what would you do if you were a principled nonviolent proponent in 1918 or 1925 or 1930. But that does raise the question, was there any way of using nonviolent tactics against an enemy as unprincipled as the Third Reich? That question was put to Gandhi on several occasions. Gandhi said some disturbing things in relation to the Nazis, and in some of his responses showed a lack of understanding. He characterized the particularly Jewish response to the Nazis as involving a kind of docility and passive response rather than active nonviolent resistance, and I think that was really quite unfair to the Jewish situation. But he also said on another occasion, against the British in India, one doesn't really see the power of nonviolence because the British are in many ways a moral people. Their military and their government are committed to certain moral standards. Against an enemy like the Nazis, then the true power of nonviolence would be disclosed. That is, against an enemy that knows no bounds, you would see just how powerful nonviolence could be. Now that, of course, was not tested in any major way. It was tested in a number of minor ways, and I think the examples are important to keep in mind as background. There was nonviolent resistance against the Third Reich in a number of cases. I'll mention just two. In Denmark, something like 93% of the Jews in Denmark escaped destruction by the Third Reich because of an extraordinarily effective, extraordinarily well-coordinated resistance campaign. The Danish were able to conceal and move Jews out of occupied territory more effectively than any other country in Europe. And they did it not with armed partisan violence, but through very carefully coordinated nonviolence. In Norway, whose neutrality was breached during the war, not really by Norwegian action, but by British action, Norway was then quickly occupied. It took practically no time, and the Norwegians, of course, knew they could not put up any effective resistance in an armed way. But there were a number of examples of very effective unarmed resistance that had a great deal to do with preserving a sense of independence, a sense of resistance against the Nazis, including refusal of Norwegian sports teams to take part in athletic contests, which seems like a trivial sort of thing, but in fact was a very important psychological bolster to the Norwegian sense of independence, and the refusal of teachers to teach Nazi propaganda in the schools. The Nazis insisted that Nazi propaganda be added to the school curriculum. Teachers refused. A number of teachers were imprisoned. They made it clear that they would not give in, and the Nazis relented. And so Nazi material was not used in Norwegian schools during the Second War. So those were examples of some kinds of resistance. They obviously didn't stop the advance of the German armies, but they did a great deal to convey to the Norwegians and the Danes a sense that though the Germans controlled their economy, their landscape, they didn't control their hearts. And the contrast with the more limited efforts of the resistance in places like France is instructive. That whole issue of resistance and its effects has been very movingly explored by many writers and filmmakers, including Marcelo Fools. Sorrow and Pity is an extraordinarily deep and complex exploration of what resistance meant. So there was resistance. What about Schindler? Does Schindler represent a kind of principled nonviolence? Clearly he does not. He was not a pacifist. He was not someone who committed himself on issues of deep principle. He was not a religious believer of any sort. He was raised a Catholic, but ceased going to Mass when he was young. He was in many ways anything but a moral hero. And yet the story that Keneally tells is the story of one who performed acts of astonishing heroism against the Nazis. And the case I'm going to make, what I think makes Schindler so interesting, is that it was in part because of his own character as a kind of opportunist, a kind of compromiser, someone who was adept at taking advantage of the basest impulses of everyone else around him. It was because of that character that he was in many ways more successful than anyone else might have been in the situation he was in. Now, the book was available in the bookstore. I'm going to presume that most of you found better things to do than read the book in the last few days, and I'll give you some summaries and read a few excerpts. If you have had a chance to read very much of it, you can help me fill in the details.
I hold it up so we see the cover. Oh, you don't have the pretty cover.
No, I don't have, no. The paperback has a nicer cover, right? I mentioned yesterday the this book is being made into a film. I think it's Steven Spielberg who picked it up, who is now filming it. This is a project he had decided to do 10 or 15 years ago and is finally actually working on. So the story will be far better known, presumably, in a year or two than it is now. So let me just fill in, in broad outlines, the story. I tried to reread the book in the last couple of days, and I intended to skim it. I read it a couple of times before, but it's been a few years since I taught it. And I just found this story is so wrenching that I couldn't skim. I found myself having to read every paragraph in many places. It's a very moving recounting of the story. Schindler was a German industrialist who saw opportunities essentially to make a buck or make a bundle of Reichsmarks in Krakow. He came in and took over a factory that had been seized by the Reich from Jewish owners, an enamel factory, and out of that built a kind of small kingdom within Krakow, obtained lucrative government contracts, obtained even military contracts. He showed himself very adept at bribery. He was a philanderer, who's someone who seems to have kept several mistresses at any time, which his wife simply tolerated, knowing she needed to. He was someone who skillfully took advantage of others' trust and skillfully invited others to be as unprincipled as he was, and regularly cut deals, engaged in under-the-counter transactions, engaged in black market deals. He was twice arrested and released, in both cases through some combination of bribery and using the influence of well-placed friends. Arrested once for alleged accounting irregularities, arrested a second time because in the flush of euphoria at a birthday party he had kissed a Jewish worker and was observed doing that. There was a little passage I was going to read about his character. And again, you know, Keneally does play up to some extent it seems sometimes as if he plays up the extent to which he was a ladies' man for the sake of the, since every novel needs sex and violence. There was a skit I heard years ago with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore where Peter Cook played a miner who had written a novel whose novel had been rejected by the editor, who said it lacked some of the basic elements of the storyteller's craft, such as sex and violence. So Keneally puts in sex and violence as needed. But Keneally writes, "To suggest, as some have, that any woman would be pleased with partial possession of Oscar is to demean the women involved. The problem was, perhaps, that if you wanted to talk to Oscar about fidelity, a look of childlike and authentic bewilderment entered his eyes, as if he were proposing some concept like relativity, which could be understood only if the listener had 5 hours to sit still and concentrate. Oscar never had 5 hours and never understood." He assumed control of this factory, which was located on the outskirts, or in a suburb of Krakow, and used Jewish workers, initially paying them wages, then following the requirements of the laws of the Third Reich, and paying wages to the central authority for Jewish prisoners, and the Jews who were initially free to live anywhere in Krakow, but then were soon closed up in a ghetto, were supposedly supplied with what was needed by the central authorities, but in fact, of course, supplied very poorly. I wanted to read a couple of passages about the conditions and the mentality of the Jewish community of Krakow and of the ghetto. It's a difficult thing to know how to construe that, and extremely difficult, I think, for us at a distance to understand just what the dynamics were in the Jewish communities that came under the Nazis. One thing, of course, we have to realize is that the truth about the Nazis' policies for extermination became known only late in the war and only partially. That is, early in the war, the Jews and others simply didn't have the information. Late in the war, of course, most of the communities of Jews in Europe did have information. Late in the war, certainly the Allies had the information and chose not to do much with it. But Keneally writes, for example, Franck, a regional governor, had managed by November 1, 1940, to move 23,000 Jewish volunteers out of Krakow. Some went to the new ghettos in Warsaw and Lodz. The gaps at table, the grieving at railway stations, can be imagined. People took it meekly, thinking, we'll do this, and that will be the brunt of what they ask. Oskar knew it was happening, but like the Jews themselves, hoped it was a temporary excess. And he says also a little later, he's writing here about Leopold Pfefferberg. Pfefferberg, who was a Jewish physical education teacher who became a friend of Schindler's, Pfefferberg said he understood the purpose of the OD, what was that, the Ordnungsdienst or something, the ghetto police, that it was not only to ensure rational behavior inside the walls, but also to achieve that correct degree of grudging tribal obedience, which in the history of European Jewry has tended to ensure that the oppressors will go away more quickly, will become forgetful so that in the interstices of their forgetfulness, life may again become feasible. That correct degree of grudging tribal obedience. There's a moving film, some of you may have seen, The Garden of the Finzi Continis, mm-hmm. which described a Jewish family in Italy, that I think conveys that sense very, very powerfully, the sense that if only we give in on this, then things will get better. And of course, that was a spectacularly wrong calculation in dealing with the Third Reich. Oskar Schindler had no intention at the beginning of doing anything particularly noble, had no intention of doing anything for the Jews of Krakow. He simply intended to make a handsome profit, to live a good life, to drive around in fast cars, to have good cognac, to have parties with well-placed friends. But he found himself confronted by something he simply couldn't believe, which was the utter inhumanity of the Nazi policies. And he found himself in a position where he committed himself, as Keneally describes it, almost on impulse, to do something to save the Jewish workers that he had to do with. A crucial moment described by Keneally has to do with when certain workers came to his factory, new night shift workers, some of whom had come in at the request of friends because they knew this was a comparatively humane place to work. There were no beatings. Let me read a paragraph or so leading up to this. That night, Edith Liebgold met the other members of the enamel factory night shift and marched across the ghetto towards Zablochi under the guard of a Jewish OD, Ordnungsdienst. In the column, she asked questions about this Deutsche Emailfabrik. They serve a soup with plenty of body, she was told. Beatings, she asked. It's not that sort of place, they said. It's not like Beckmann's razor blade factory, more like Madrid, a textile manufacturer in Krakow. At the entrance of the factory, the new night shift workers were called out of the column by banquier and taken upstairs and past vacant desks to a door marked Herr Direktor. Edith Liebgold heard a deep voice tell them all to come in. They found the Herr Direktor seated in the corner of his desk smoking a cigarette. His hair, somewhere between blonde and light brown, looked freshly brushed. He wore a double-breasted suit and a silk tie. He looked exactly like a man who had a dinner to go to but had waited specially to have a word with him. He was immense. He was still young. From such a Hitlerite dream, Edith expected a lecture on the war effort and increasing production quotas. I wanted to welcome you, he told him in Polish. You're part of the expansion of this factory. He looked away. It was even possible he was thinking, don't tell them that. I've got no stake in this place. Then, without blinking, without any introduction, any qualifying lift of the shoulders, he told them, you'll be safe working here. If you work here, then you'll live through the war. Then he said goodnight and left the office with them, allowing Banquier to hold them back at the head of the stairs so that the Herr Direktor could go down first and get behind the wheel of his automobile. The promise had dazed them all. It was a godlike promise. How could a mere man make a promise like that? But Edith Liebgold found herself believing it instantly, not so much because she wanted to, not because it was a sop, a reckless incentive. It was because in the second Herr Schindler uttered the promise, it left no option but belief. Now, there's obviously a good deal of novelization of the immediate situations, but keep in mind that Keneally's principal source was the Schindler Juden themselves, the survivors, many of whom now live in Israel, and many of whom he interviewed of their recollections. So he found himself making promises to his Jewish workers that they would survive the war if they worked with him. He realized gradually what he was up against in the Nazi policies. And there's a very moving description, of which I'll read a little bit, of that Keneally uses as a kind of encapsulated moment of realization for Schindler about what exactly was the Nazis' policies. This happens at a time when the Jews had already been crowded into the ghetto, when there were many arrests, when there were people being sent off to labor camps in some cases, mm-hmm. when there was a great deal of concern over having proper papers, and when the papers kept being new requirements. But there were not mass killings, and the rumors of the camps, there were rumors of deaths in the camps, but they were unconfirmed and no one really knew what was going on. Schindler goes for a ride on the hills above the ghetto, where he has a clear view down at the ghetto, very close by, and he sees the Waffen-SS forces, the Sonderkommando, along with the Ordnungsdienst, the Jewish ghetto police, pulling people out of their apartments, lining them up in the streets, dividing them into several lines. And let me read a little of this, because it you know, captures the flavor of what Cornelius sees Schindler as having been moved by. Oscar and Ingrid, his mistress, turned their horses, crossed the deserted avenue, rode out onto a limestone platform facing directly down Krakuza Street. A line of women and children, not so long, was being led away toward Pivna Street. A guard walked in front, another strolled behind. There was an imbalance in the line. Far more children than the few women in it could themselves have borne. At the rear, dawdling was a toddler, boy or girl, dressed in a small scarlet coat and cap. The reason that compelled Schindler's interest was that it made a statement, the way the argumentative shift worker in Vigirska had. The statement had to do, of course, with the passion for red. Ingrid said it was definitely a little girl. Girls got obsessed by a color, especially a color like that. As they watched, the Waffen-SS man at the rear of the column would occasionally put his hand out and correct the drift of the scarlet note. He did not do it harshly. He could have been an elder brother. Had he been asked by his officers to do something to allay the sentimental concern of watching civilians, he could not have done better. So the moral anxiety of the two riders was for a second irrationally delayed. But it was a brief comfort, for behind the departing column of women and children, to which the scarlet toddler placed a meandering period, SS teams with dogs worked north along either side of the street. They rampaged through the fetid apartments. As a symptom of their rush, a suitcase flew from a second-story window and split open on the sidewalk. And running before the dogs, the men and women and children who had hidden in attics or closets, inside drawerless dressers, the evaders of the first wave of search, jolted out onto the pavement, yelling and gasping in terror at the Doberman pinchers. Everything seemed speeded up, difficult for the viewers on the hill to track. Those who had emerged were shot where they stood on the sidewalk, flying out over the gutters at the impact of the bullets, gushing blood into the drains. A mother and a boy, perhaps 8, perhaps a scrawny 10, had retreated under a windowsill on the western side of Krakuza Street. Schindler felt an intolerable fear for them, terror in his own blood, which loosened his thighs from his saddle and threatened to unhorse him. He looked at Ingrid and saw her hands knotted on the reins. He could hear her exclaiming and begging beside him. His eyes screwed up Krakuza to the scarlet child. They were doing it within half a block of her. They hadn't waited for her column to turn out of sight into Josefinska. Schindler could not have explained at first how that compounded the murders on the sidewalk, yet somehow it proved, in a way no one could ignore, their serious intent. While the scarlet child stopped in her column and turned to watch, they shot the woman in the neck, and one of them, when the boy slid down the wall whimpering, jammed a boot down on his head as if to hold it still and put the barrel against the back of his neck, the recommended SS stance, and fired. Oscar looked again for the small red girl. She had stopped and turned and seen the boot descend. A gap had already widened between her and the next in the column. Again, the SS guard corrected her drift fraternally and nudged her back into line. Herr Schindler could not see why he did not bludgeon her with his rifle, but since at the other end of Krakuza Street, mercy had been canceled. At last, Schindler slipped from his horse, tripped, and found himself on his knees, hugging the trunk of a pine tree. The urge to throw up his excellent breakfast was, he sensed, to be suppressed, for he suspected it meant that all his cunning body was doing was making room to digest the horrors of Krakuza Street. Their lack of shame as men who had been born of women and had to write letters home, what did they put in them? Wasn't the worst aspect of what he had seen. He knew they had no shame, since the guard at the base of the column had not felt any need to stop the red child from seeing things. But worst of all, if there was no shame, it meant there was official sanction. No one could find refuge any more behind the idea of German culture, nor behind those pronouncements uttered by leaders to exempt anonymous men from stepping beyond their gardens, from looking out their office windows to the reality of the sidewalk. Oscar had seen in Krakuza Street a statement of his government's policy which could not be written off as a temporary aberration. The SS men were, Oscar believed, fulfilling there the orders of the leader, for otherwise their colleague at the rear of the column would not have let a child watch. Later in the day, after he had absorbed a ration of brandy, Oscar understood the proposition in its clearest terms. They permitted witnesses, such witnesses as the red toddler, because they believed the witnesses all would perish too. So Schindler realizes that all of the assurances about reuse of labor, about sparing the Jews, about relocating them, and so forth, are empty promises because of the way in which they don't take the trouble to hide anything. And there are several other places involving the labor camp when he says, the fact that they allowed the inmates to witness this means that these people are all doomed, that they are clearly marked for death. So he then determines to save the workers with whom he has any contact in whatever way may be appropriate. And just to summarize quickly the remainder of the story, when the workers are relocated to a labor camp, he refuses to allow his factory to be moved into the labor camp as the local commandant requests, but instead puts up a dormitory behind his labor camp for his workers, and has obtained enough high-level contacts and enough military commissions to be able to resist the commandant's requests and, in effect, to defy him and say, no, I won't move into the labor camp. He moves his workers into that compound. He moves more and more Jewish workers, the relatives of those who are already working in his factory, relatives of others, responding to people who in one way or another manage to see him and make requests, moves more and more of the Jews of Krakow into his camp. Saves them from the repeated campaigns that of sifting in the labor camp, in which only the very healthiest are preserved and the others are sent off to death camps. He also begins working quite extensively with the underground, with the Jewish underground, and traveling to Budapest and elsewhere to give reports. And his own involvement, his position, give those reports a credibility that other sources don't have. And so he's able, in some ways, to convince the network of outside supporters that the rumors of death camps are true. Though he doesn't himself witness the death camps, he does see plans for crematoria, for ovens. He sees technical specifications for ovens, and has really irrefutable evidence of the beginnings of mass killings at the various camps. So he becomes much more directly involved, but still very confidentially, and still preserves his good relations, still sends bribes, sends cases of brandy to the local commandant, still has dinner with them. When the camp is dismantled, and all the Jewish workers are to be sent away, he is notified that his factory is to be closed. He pulls off what is really the most astonishing stunt, and really defies belief, when he manages to relocate the entire factory into the mountains of Moldavia by arranging to transform it into a munitions factory, and saves not only his own workers, but even the workers from another, from Madrich's plant, from the textile plant. And he makes up a list of 1,000 workers. This is the source of the book's title. And places on this list not only his workers, but also others whom he knows or whom his friends know. He relocates the factory into the rural area of the mountains. He makes munitions, but he manages to... And you know, this begins to sound like a Marx Brothers story almost, instead of a true story. He manages so to fudge all of the various specifications that he ensures that not one of the metal missile or armament artillery pieces he produces can ever be used. They're all faulty, and he keeps making apologies. He says, you know, these Jewish workers are so incompetent, they can't follow the right. But he himself and his foreman are deliberately sabotaging the entire operation. They're setting the ovens that temper the steel at the wrong temperature. They're introducing impurities. In one way or another, he makes sure that everything he produces fails some crucial test or other and can't be used. So he not only protects his Jewish workers, but runs this thriving munitions factory, receiving payments from the German military machine, and makes sure that everything, every penny they spend is wasted, because they can't even use what he produces. And that's essentially the story. The war ends, the workers are freed, and in fact he has kept his promise. All those who worked for his factory were saved through a complex network of trickery, chicanery, deceit, bribery, deception, and generally underhanded dealings. The Schindler story after the war is rather sad, and if you read, or if you had a chance to read to the end, he seems like a man who is an extraordinary hero during the war, who then doesn't quite know what to do with himself after the war. He died in the early 80s, I think, in Israel. But there is a tree in his memory. of the righteous among the nations in Jerusalem, which I've seen. And I believe it's true that he's the only Gentile who has a tree. No, that's not right. The rest of the nations is Gentiles. He has a...
Wallenberg
is there. He is remembered in some place where other than Schindler, all those remembered are Jews. But the righteous among the nations is specifically for Gentiles. So that's the story. And it's the story of someone who, it seems to me, is a very good counterexample to the notion that morality of means always leads to morality of ends. That is, it's a good counterexample to thinking that heroism involves being attentive to the usual virtues of the moral life. And Schindler was a person who possessed relatively few of the usual virtues of fidelity, faithfulness, being trustworthy, being truthful, and the like. And yet, by contrast with those who were more principled, whether Jewish or Gentile, in Krakow, accomplished far more. Moreover, those who were more principled seemed very quickly to come under, those who were more principled among the Jews didn't escape the fate of the rest of the Jews. Those who, among the Jews, thought that they could manage to, in one way or another, to mediate, to create a space for the Jewish community to continue, one by one were wiped out. And there's a kind of progression in the story from the initially rather principled man who has a respect for the Jewish community, who runs the local Judenrat, the local Jewish council, who is sent off to a camp, to the less principled person who is really much more a collaborator, who stepped into that role, and he himself is soon killed, to the Jewish men who run the Ordnungsdienst, the most obvious collaborator with the Nazis, who think surely their position will protect them, and they in turn are killed, are executed when the German commanders decide they're no longer useful. So that all those who either through trying to act on principle or trying to mediate think that they can accomplish something are wiped out. But Schindler, an outsider, a kind of manipulator, a kind of maker of deals, manages to find a place in which he can work enough different angles that his own growing determination not to allow any of his workers to fall into the maw of the Nazi machine is actually fulfilled. Well, let me invite your responses and comments and questions about this. I think it's the kind of story that needs to be told and known as we look for examples of heroes. It's the kind of moral story that needs to be placed alongside those of people who are more transparently and more consistently committed to the principles of morality. That is, it shows how someone in a certain situation can feel himself called to act on principle, as Schindler, by Cornelius' description, felt himself sickened by the violence that he saw and determined not in any way to contribute to it, can accomplish far more than others who, from an abstract point of view, would seem far more clearly to exemplify moral standards.
I don't know whether it would be helpful or not. I might give you a little information about people who are in principle objection to military activity and their reactions. For 8 or 10 years after the Second World War, I was a conscientious objector hearing officer for the Department of Justice. That position is one that's filled by a lawyer who volunteers his time to conduct these hearings. I suppose that I heard maybe 150 instances of conscientious objectors. And I didn't do it in an all systematic way, but I tried to, at the end of that process, when the draft was no longer applicable in the United States, to generalize in my own mind what had brought those men. There were only men because we, at that time, did not conscript women. What had brought them to that position in their life? And to generalize rather wildly. 25%, I would guess, were people who simply did not want to be in the military for reasons of convenience and perhaps fear. The Korean War in the early days of the Vietnamese War certainly had that effect on a number of people. On the other end of the spectrum, I can remember perhaps a dozen people who were very thoughtful, very convinced that military action was bad in all instances, no matter what was going on in the ghetto, and made excellent statements on that behalf. The bulk, by far, of the people that I heard were people who belonged to an organization. I hate to be particular about, for example, to take one that everyone must know about, the Jehovah's Witnesses group that said that military service was wrong and was to be rejected if you were drafted. Of that group of people, I would say that the great majority of them, of that group, were people who didn't really have any thought about conscientious objection or objection to warfare, but were told by people that they respected that this was the course that they should follow, usually rewarded rather generously by being made persons who were permitted to give speeches in their own gatherings and were made folk heroes, really, but under brutal questioning by a conscientious objector hearing, did not display any evidence of personal persuasion or understanding what they were doing. I guess that brings me down to a relatively small group of people who were what I would call committed, thoughtful persons who objected to military service, violence generally, all violence. A favorite tract of persons who were doing what I was doing was to say, how do you feel about the police and other kinds of force. And that group, I think, would have gone to the wall before they would have been in the military. I don't know whether that tracks at all with what you're saying, but for me, it was a very revealing kind of experience. I should say that I myself was a pacifist before Pearl Harbor, a member of the Air Force after Pearl Harbor, and my 3 years of combat left me with a great deal of ambivalence about this entire question. One reason why I was interested in the conscientious security routine.
And that's an interesting observation. It suggests that the motives and the level of understanding vary enormously among those who either among those who support war selectively or oppose war. That, you know, in a way, what you said brings to my mind some aspects of the story I mentioned earlier of the town of Le Chambon-sur-Saône in France, which is told by Philip Halley in the book Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, because that story is a story of courageous resistance to the Nazis, in that case by an entire community, not just by one person. But many of those who show extraordinary courage in risking death to harbor Jews and partisan fighters do so not because they feel a deep principled obligation, but just because they see others doing it and they think it's the only decent thing to do. In fact, Trocmé's wife, Trocmé himself has a rather strong theological ground for what he does. Trocmé's wife simply says to Philip Halley, who interviewed her, there they were, so I had to take care of them. What can one do? It's only the human thing to do. She had no real principled basis on which she acted. And Schindler is a kind of combination of principles being called into question and simple occasions.
Only one further thought, and then I'll leave it alone, and that is that obviously these men that I talked to all knew the Second World War story, and by that time everyone knew about the atrocities. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That seems to have been a very minor element, actually, in the decisions that most people reached. The great majority of them said, this is my community, and this is what my community thinks, and I am a member of this community, and I'm loyal to this community, right, wrong, indifferent, I don't even think about it. That's what they say, that's what they do.
Here, have you seen?
Are you referring to those French people who took in the Jews? I remember them saying, what else could we do? We're Christians. And so that's the principle that they have.
Yeah.
It was just simply an accepted thing, and they made no bones about it. They needed our care and our love, and they gave it freely.
What you say about both that thought and the observation about the Jehovah's Witnesses and others, it does suggest that if we think about the issue of violence and nonviolence as a matter of forming individual conscience, we probably are undertaking a hopeless task. That is, to try to mobilize individual conscience against violence is a rather haphazard and piecemeal thing. That the most effective way of shaping conscience is through shaping communities. That's communities that shape our thinking. And those who see their task as a Christian to help those who are in need will do so. Those who see their duty as Jehovah's Witness, even if they don't understand it very deeply, will respond. Yes?
What are your thoughts about the books that are being written on people who think there was no Holocaust?
That there are few bounds to the lengths to which people will go to attract attention, I guess.
Okay. Or their anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't pretend to understand that. It's
so much evidence.
What do you think Keneally wants us to think of Shiver?
Who?
The author.
Keneally.
Why do you write the book?
When I read this book, I immediately started looking for other books by Keneally, and I don't find in his other work any signs of the kind of moral passion that I find here. He seems to have a passion to tell the story, to give witness to the story. And yet, his other novels, they're good novels, they're interesting novels, but they don't have that kind of moral fire to convey the story.
Yes, but that's part of what I'm getting at. Is he writing a novel so that ethics props like you will have good stumpers someday? Because the other novels don't do this,
yeah.
Or is it somebody who just in the course of his life runs across a case that is so qualitatively different than others,
yeah.
In the act of telling it, he couldn't help but come up with something.
Yeah. Well, I think probably the latter.
He's not the community who wrote about Australia.
Yeah?
The same?
Yeah, he has a book about Australia.
Okay.
He's written 12 or 15 novels. Yeah. Yeah, he is Australian, in fact, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So the Australian, the settlement of Australia is often looked upon as a form of a Holocaust. I mean, in the sense that it was so, such inhumane behavior.
That's produced some fine novels.
Yes.
Transplanted cultures often produce very interesting novels.
Okay, sure.
Like the English-speaking writers of South Africa produce extraordinarily powerful novels.
Will you teach this to undergraduates? It's Grandpa's War.
Yeah.
Very, very far behind you.
Yeah.
What are some characteristic attitudes you get out of the class?
Well, frankly, one of the things I find most difficult is to persuade undergraduates that there's anything at all morally undesirable about this guy, that his willingness to make deals, to keep mistresses and so forth, say, oh, that's all trivial. Who cares about that anymore? I find it a little disturbing they seem to see conventional morality as, you know, so obviously ho-hum, who cares? I don't think they actually act on that impulse, but they tend to be, at least in the abstract, thoroughgoing defenders of a kind of carefree relativism But it does seem to hit them in a way. Keneally does, I read you one example, there are other equally moving and wrenching descriptions of the kind of senseless brutality, little snapshots of isolated incidents of execution that reveal the kind of brutality. And that seems to, that in the end, books like this, an initial response from students tends often to have a kind of carefree relativism about it. In the end, students simply cannot defend a relativistic position. No student I've ever met would say, well, Schindler was right to oppose Nazism because he was into that, and that was his; those are his values, but if my values are different, maybe I shouldn't. It does, considering examples like Nazism tend to shake out relativists into people who aren't really relativists.
Well, going back to the statement that she just made, that people who now are questioning the Holocaust and things of this sort, we've worked with the actual photos, military intelligence,
mm-hmm.
That were being brought in from the field and prepared this big booklet. It was called the Z Gene because we were in propaganda at that time. And I find it so hard, and having seen places like Dachau and Auschwitz, we have all of these facts, we have these pictures, we have these stories, I mean, completely embedded in all of our archives in Washington, so that anyone who questions it, the whole story is there, the actual photos and everything of that sort. And I remember when, after the war ended, we went up into about Hamburg, Germany, which was outside of Frankfurt, and had a little house on the end of the compound. Had a German man, a little German gardener, and I was going to be one of those real tough ones. Boy, I wasn't giving them anything. They weren't getting any so-called for me or this kind of stuff. This little woman, she was so sweet, and I got very ill at that time, and she just took care of me so beautifully. I mean, that you just couldn't help. I mean, she was a human being. And we talked to her about Hitler and the things that Hitler had done. And she would just shake her head, and she'd cry. And this is something, this man that they never saw. I mean, all they saw was somebody who came out and petted the little kids on the head and gave them their hot dogs and their beer and their sauerkraut and this kind of little get together out in the park in Bad Homburg, and they never saw this other side of Hitler, and they found it very difficult to believe that he did these atrocities.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're educated on this, and we see this, and for people to say, oh, I don't believe it, that ever happened, it's so easy to just go into the archives and see all of this, because I know I've managed to get a lot of this stuff home. I have copies of all of our leaflets that we dropped on the in different places. And I think to myself, my grandchildren aren't interested in that. You want to see this? You know, I'll grab it maybe sometime. And I think I got a wealth of information here. What am I going to do with it? Just, they don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel it should be given to somebody who could use it in teaching or something of that sort. Because when I'm gone, that's going to go too. But but here's the whole scene here, and the propaganda that the Germans used was excellent propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when I read now about the Nazi skinheads and things of that sort, it scares the dickens out of me.
Yeah, it's really some of the same fears are being tapped today that were tapped so effectively by Hitler. You know, the other side of that story, as we look at back, and there are many, many stories of real heroism in the war, both in military action and in cases like Schindler and others in the resistance. But the story of the Allies' response is not a terribly morally pure story. And you know, people working with the archives, like who's the Abandonment of the Jews by, is it David Wiley? Is that the name? Came out about 10 years ago, which tells the story of how the Allied command had very detailed information about the extermination campaigns against the Jews and chose not to try and disrupt it because the war effort, essentially, the Allies placed military effectiveness over saving the lives of Jews. That was a clear and
too, because
and also the story that he tells too is rather chilling, is the juxtaposition of a vigorous American war effort with a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism going on at home. And he quotes speeches in the United States Senate from people saying, at the same time that we're supporting the war effort against Hitler, people talking about how terrible the influence of Jews is in American culture. So our record was not very pure. We certainly were on the better side, there's no question of that, but we didn't act in a way that represented clear identification of the most urgent moral needs, either.
That brings to mind one of the pieces of propaganda that I got, which was German propaganda, which was very effective, and it was a dollar bill. And it was true on both sides, but it opened up. And this is what the Germans dropped. And of course, even in the midst of everything, at that time, a dollar bill meant something to the Americans, where if you see a dollar bill laying down, you can stop and pick it up. And when you opened it up, it had the Jewish star and Morgenthau, and these were the ones who were backing the American war. I mean, it's a very effective piece of propaganda.
Yes.
The Atwater, all of this, Somalia and Bosnia?
I was thinking the same, but I agree with you on Wyman's book, Abandonment of the Jews.
Well, Wyman, that's right, not Wiley.
Wyman.
Yeah.
Abandonment of the Jews. That is, we were so preoccupied with finishing the war that we didn't deter from that. But years from now, people can say the same about Bosnia now. But I'm not somebody who's going to vote for sending American ground troops to a place where 1,000 years from now they'll still be fighting a war. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm just trying to get back into the mesh of this. Why your students might say Schindler, for all his skullduggery, did something that in its own way looks more heroic than the alternative.
Yeah.
Yeah, I may have missed it at the beginning, but is the argument here that Schindler is a pacifist?
No, no, by no means.
Okay, I was going to say
there's no evidence that he was.
Not.
No, I don't know. There's concrete evidence that he's a supporter of military force, but there's no evidence that he's a pacifist.
Okay, that's what I wasn't clear on, because I would argue very strongly that he's not.
No, and certainly his tactics are not those of nonviolence. His tactics are those of taking advantage wherever you can.
Yeah, the other, kind of react to what you said about how your students react to it. I would hunch that it's ho-hum in the sense that they've heard it so much. It's been storied out, in one sense, that you have heard variations of the same theme from about 1,000 different directions. Mm-hmm. And if you're asking them to look for something new, or to look for, you're asking them to get their juices flowing and stimulate their thoughts about this, you're handing them old hat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something that they've heard people discussing and debating, the rights and wrongs and various decibel arguments for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That just as you will now begin hearing and are hearing already the arguments about the breakup of Yugoslavia,
mm-hmm,
and what's happening there. The ethical question, or the pacifist question, or the nonviolent question there, nobody's doing anything. I mean, lots of sound and fury and posturing and so forth,
mm-hmm,
but the so-called allies of the big countries are consciously, deliberately doing nothing, and then trying to explain why they're doing nothing. I'm not going to say that's right or wrong, because I don't know, but there's something that isn't quite right in my mind about being able to ethnically cleanse mm-hmm. an area. What makes that any different than cleaning out a ghetto?
Right, right. Now the analogies between Nazi actions and Serbian actions are uncomfortably close. Though of course the role of the Serbs and Croats in World War II was, the Croats were the collaborators, the Serbs were the resistors. The moral tables have turned completely.
Those people over there have been fighting each other for centuries. And they are the type of people that don't seem to want to forget. They don't have a desire to let it go. Mm-hmm. They hang on to things that are cancerous.
And what brought a temporary lull in the conflict was a central authority that was sufficiently absolutist to mm-hmm. provide a common enemy for everyone to mm-hmm. criticize.
Put a lid on.
We're out of time. I wanted to get your. I'm wondering if your students are ever interested in what makes this sort of person. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's sort of the direction in which I try to push it. That is, what was it that came into play at those, that moment looking down from his horse? What was it that made him feel, I cannot tolerate this? As opposed to feeling, oh my, look what they're doing now, I can't stop them. What was it that made him determined to use every resource he had to stop this machine?
Which seems so inconsistent with the sort of person he wants. It's a very intriguing case for me.
Yeah.
The etiological issues are what so fascinate me about this particular case. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all operate on a hierarchy of values, or at least that's a fairly common way of assessing moral judgments. But this is an extraordinary case. One wonders what is the environment that shapes such a person mm-hmm. to a rogue who simply sees something that his roguery cannot handle. In fact, he recruits it to a moral end. So that's a very curious sort of moral hero.
Well, it raises the challenge. One way of putting what I see as the challenge of a story like Schindler's is, what resources do we have to mobilize to ensure that our society, that everyone in our society will have at least the moral motivation that Schindler had? Our society can tolerate a good deal of minor vice, and it's not going to make a whole lot of difference to future generations if we wipe out philandering and adultery. It's existed for generations, it's going to exist for, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference to wipe out bribery and doing deals under the table. We'd like to, a better, more rational society, a fairer society, but it makes an enormous amount of difference to the future society if people have this fundamental sense, as Keneally describes it, how can someone born of woman do this? How can anyone who has to write home to his family do this sort of thing? And this sense of revulsion that motivates tremendous effort. That is absolutely crucial to the survival of the race. And that was so conspicuously absent in many, many millions of people from 1939 to 1945. People who had the best moral upbringing that the Western world could offer, who nevertheless were completely corrupted into cooperation with that regime. Keneally paints some interesting portraits of some of them as well. Some of the Nazi functionaries who actually did try to subvert the system from within. Some of them who were unprincipled. He talks about Eamon Goeth, who he says in a way was Schindler's dark shadow, the person that Schindler might have become, a high-living, sybaritic, opportunistic man who rises high in the Nazi machinery and then, in fact, is tried and executed. Yeah, that's the real challenge. What are the resources we need to implant in students and children and citizens that when it comes to a choice to tolerate or not to tolerate, they will choose not to tolerate?
What was the record of the church in World War II? I understand the Catholic Church didn't come out shining in this. I don't know what the other churches, that religious, the Danes, was that kind of a religious type organization?
I don't know. I guess